trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, touching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
Breakthrough.
Welcome to Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news, brought to you for an hour each week. I'm Eugene Perrier. Today we're discussing the roots of Israeli apartheid policies, the devastating impact of sanctions policy, and the possibility of a new global South-centered lithium cartel. But first, some headlines. Bolivian President Luis Arce and members of Bolivia's business community have agreed to start conducting Bolivia's trade with China in the Chinese currency, the yuan, as opposed to the dollar, as it's currently done. The Chinese ambassador to Bolivia has also been meeting with the business community in Bolivia and discussing the possibility of one or more Chinese banks opening branches in the South American country. Greek elections that took place this past Sunday, May 21st, ended inconclusively as no party reached a simple majority. Current ruling party New Democracy, a right-wing party, led with 40% of the vote, while the main opposition party, the center-left Syriza, saw a significant slide in votes, ending in second place with 20%. The former ruling party, center-left PASOK, and the Communist Party saw significant gains, as did the far-right Greek Solutions Party. Elections will now move to a second round in early June. Now to our first story. The roots of Israel's apartheid policies run deep, back to its earliest manifestations. Despite what Americans are taught, Israel was not created as a safe haven from oppression. In fact, the origin of Israel has anti-Arab and imperialist roots. Brian Becker, host of the Socialist Program on Breakthrough News, is joined by Dr. Nazia Kazi, a professor of anthropology at Stockton University and author of the book Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics, to discuss all of this history.
An historic gathering, the first ever at the United Nations on Monday, commemorated al-Nakba, which means the catastrophe, and marked the beginning of the apartheid state of Israel and the massacre and displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian people from their homes. In the last days, Nakba, the catastrophe, has been marked by demonstrations, rallies, activities all around the world, not just in the Middle East, not just in Palestine, but even in Washington, D.C. I was at a protest right outside the White House, mainly young Palestinians, people whose grandparents would have been the ones driven from their historic ancestral homes. And while there are demonstrations every year marking al-Nakba, the catastrophe, this time it was at the United Nations. And the Israeli government went on a diplomatic war drive to try to prevent countries from attending. They tried to get countries to boycott. And the United States and Britain and a few other countries did. But most of the world was there. And the head of the Palestinian Authority, who's certainly no radical, called for the Israeli government to be expelled or at least suspended from UN membership because the Israeli state has violated more than 1,000 resolutions that have been passed over the decades, both at the General Assembly and at the United Nations. It seems to me, Professor, that while the U.S. is steadfast in its defense of the Israeli apartheid government, it's becoming ever more isolated.
Absolutely. I'm reminded of the soccer games, the World Cup that happened, and, you know, just the global show of solidarity with the Palestinian cause. And this has been true for quite some time. The global community is able to see, and increasingly this applies to the U.S. too, just how, you know, repressive the state of Israel is. I mean, for those of us who have been paying attention to, you know, the violence of Israeli settler colonialism, when, you know, Amnesty declares that it has found Israel to be a practitioner of apartheid, we're kind of like, well, duh, you know, it's obvious. It's like saying the sky is blue. But this was a major demonstration of just how legitimate the claims of the, you know, Palestinian resistance movement have become. This became very clear during the various Movement for Black Lives uprisings, both in 2020 and in 2014, when we saw parallels being made between the violence and repression of the Israeli occupation forces, also known as the IDF, and the violence of U.S. police forces, which many times received direct training from the Israeli military. We see increasing literature, books, scholarship being published comparing, you know, the repression of indigenous people in the U.S. to the repression of indigenous people in Palestine. So, you know, you're absolutely right to highlight how the global community is able to recognize what for quite some time both the U.S. and Israel have tried to shroud. Now, when it comes to the United Nations, this is a really interesting question, because absolutely, we see, you know, what happened on Nakba Day at the UN as just another one of these instances where it's becoming increasingly impossible to deny the violence of Israeli settler colonialism. But of course, for those of us who know our history, and I'm sure we'll get into this a bit more soon, it was the UN that was sort of complicit in handing over Palestine, you know, to the British mandate and ultimately to Zionist settlement. So there's a really ambivalent history there that perhaps we can talk about.
Yeah, indeed. I want to get into that. I think it's really important that we, the audience, we, the people of the United States, we, the people of the world, have a full understanding of the history because, you know, the U.S. presents the contest, the combat, the struggle, the confrontation in Palestine as a struggle between peoples or a religious struggle, rather than framing it as what it really is, as a historic struggle against colonialism and a struggle by colonialism to impose a colonial power on indigenous people. So I want to get into that. But I do want to just flag this point that you just highlighted about the UN. When the world started to come together and boycott racist South Africa in the early 1980s, and it became sort of a fad almost, people were getting arrested all over the world. It made a difference because the boycott of the South African racist apartheid regime made the continuation of that regime, well, it made its days numbered. And eventually the United States recognized that. Also, there was other international factors, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the ability perhaps to have a negotiated rather than a revolutionary solution to the problem of apartheid led to a negotiated outcome. But this is where things were with South Africa 40 years ago. The world started to move together. And I just want to highlight that what appears to be an ever-present, omnipotent state apparatus like the South African government appeared to be actually can fall. I want to play a quick clip from Al Jazeera. It was made in sort of advance of al-Nakba, the catastrophe. But I think it's only about 35 seconds, but I want to play it and then get your reaction.
70 years have passed since the Nakba, the catastrophe in Arabic, took place in Palestine in 1948, in which more than 750,000 Palestinians were forcefully displaced from their homes and pushed into refugee camps in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and neighboring countries. But the Nakba didn't end in 1948. The catastrophe continues to affect more than 12 million Palestinians who remain stateless today. Historical Palestine was mostly made up of Palestinian Muslims, Christians, and a small number of Jews who generally lived together peacefully.
You know, it's so interesting. We have, what is it, 12 million refugees or 12 million descendants of people who were driven from their homes. And as that little clip makes clear, the Middle East and Palestine in particular, historic Palestine, it had Muslims and Christians in the majority. This is the birthplace of Jesus. It's a very holy place for Islam and for Judaism. It had a smaller number of indigenous Jewish residents, but those people lived in peace for thousands of years. I mean, literally a couple thousand years, or more or less in peace. Maybe it wasn't always, you know, smooth sailing, but there wasn't any major war between them. And then there's endless war, and the presentation here is, oh, these people just can't get along, when it's obvious that the people did get along, that actually isn't the problem.
Yeah, around the same time that the Nakba occurred, another major catastrophe occurred in my own in India, right? With this huge mass migration of people across borders as India and Pakistan formed. And the same kind of logic that is applied there, that there are these two groups of people, Hindus and Muslims, who just simply can't get along. It's this age-old conflict is what we see, is what you're referring to with what takes place in conversations about Israel and Palestine, that there's some kind of almost like quintessential, primordial, innate hostility between groups of people who just simply can't get along. And this is one of the tricks of racism. This is one of the tricks of racist colonialism, to make hostility and ethnic strife or religious strife, to make them unconnected to political and material contexts. So for what you're pointing to, the ways in which, you know, Palestine included a range of religious and ethnic communities who largely got along, forces us to think about how it was the, you know, colonial project that not only created these hostilities, but relied on these divisions and these hostilities in order to function. And the same is true anywhere we see racial capitalism, really. I mean, the same is true of the American racial order, you know, that the divisions we often see were produced, were stoked to serve a project, a political project. And in this case, it was the project of the creation of a colonial state in the Middle East.
Yeah, and let's go back to the World War I period. I mean, World War I, if you ask people, what was World War I about? Most people can't tell you. I mean, Bob Dylan, in his song With God on Our Side, he actually has a whole verse out about it. He says, World War I came and it went. The reason for fighting I never did get. But I learned to accept it and accept it with pride, for you don't count the dead when God's on your side. Meaning everybody was going off to slaughter each other. God was on everybody's side, or so their governments told them. But World War I was a war that can be explained. It was a war for colonies between the different, especially European colonial empires. And there were important sort of decisions made, mainly made in secret. There was the Sykes-Picot Treaty signed by the British and the French in Tsarist Russia. I think that was in 1916. They expected the Central Powers that included the Ottoman Empire to be defeated. And then the Ottoman Empire's Arab lands were going to be divided between the victors. And that would have included Britain, France, and Tsarist Russia. And then the Russian Revolution happened, and the Bolsheviks under Lenin exposed the treaty. That's the reason, the only reason we know about it, was that the secret deal was made between British and French colonialism to divide up the Arab world. And Palestine, as well as the rest of the Arab world, what we today call Syria or Iraq or Lebanon, they're all divided up by the colonial powers, and it had nothing to do with Jewish people. I mean, the word Jews does not appear in any of those discussions about Sykes-Picot. Let's just, again, go into this a little bit more for the history. The thing that actually people don't have and the thing that prevents people from actually understanding what's going on today.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, the Sykes-Picot Agreement in 1916 was signed on May 16th. So this week commemorates the creation of this, as you say, secret agreement and a secret colonial agreement. Okay, Sykes-Picot was a top-down project spearheaded by two very rich people, Mark Sykes and Francois Picot, a British man and a Frenchman. Of course, Mark Sykes would later be key in the Balfour Declaration, which I'm sure we can get into soon. But this was a top-down project. As with all colonial projects, there was no Palestinian at the table. The Palestinians were not consulted. Arabs were not consulted. This was a European project. For those who know about, for instance, the Scramble for Africa, it's a very similar instance of European powers sitting down at a table and deciding what happens with another region, with a region that has been marked as open to colonial domination. And of course, through Sykes-Picot, the French and the British decide how to parcel out the Middle East, cutting through ethnic communities, cutting through religious communities. So, you know, there is, especially in the U.S., this popular idea that over there, the Middle East, people just can't get along. There's all this ethnic strife. There's all this, you know, religious hostility and divisions, which ignores, once again, how those divisions were exacerbated or even created through this project of parceling out and dividing up the region we call, you know, the Middle East. So Sykes-Picot, really what it did was it decided which regions would be under quote unquote direct French control, which regions would be under direct or formal British control, which would be under quote unquote British influence, which would be under French influence, and then for the purposes of our discussion, which would be a so-called international zone. You're right to point to how it was Lenin who exposed this secret agreement after the overthrow of the Russian Tsar. In fact, when he discovered it, he called it appropriately the Treaty of Colonial Thieves. I mean, let's be clear, between World War I and World War II, there's a drastic change in the global economy. Oil becomes perhaps the most important global commodity, and the world powers are quickly figuring out ways to gain control and hold on to control of oil rich regions. I mean, this really becomes sort of an obsession in the West. I mean, that's, we can't understand the British in Iran, for instance, without understanding the legacy of oil. So, you know, this is an important precursor to the establishment of the State of Israel.
The endless pogroms and repression and massacre of Jewish people in Europe certainly predated the rise of Nazism and the Holocaust and the killing of millions of Jews and others, Roma people, gay people, communists, socialists, Ukrainians, Russians in particular, people in the Baltics. I mean, the Holocaust wasn't simply imposed on the Jewish population. It was a terrible genocide and a terrible war, a war that took almost 100 million lives in 5 years. Like, unbelievable. Nothing like that had ever happened in human history. But this oppression of Jews in Europe by European feudalists and then European capitalists, it was a hallmark of Europe for many centuries, not simply under the Nazi period. And the British government didn't care about Jews, and the French government didn't care about Jews, and certainly Tsarist Russia didn't care about Jews. None of them cared about Jews. But after the Sykes-Picot Treaty, where there's this secret deal made between Britain, France, and Russia, Tsarist Russia, to divide up the Arab lands amongst themselves. In other words, it was going to become the new colonial power replacing the decline or defeated Ottoman Empire. During that time, when the area of what is called Palestine was, couldn't be decided upon by those countries. There was, the British wanted it, and the French said no, and the French wanted it, and the British said no. So they said, okay, as you mentioned, it'll be an international zone. And then after the Sykes-Picot Treaty, the British government was very, very critical of Sykes-Picot because they thought British colonialism should have Palestine. And it was then, it was only then that the British colonial imperialist government decided that they needed a cause rather than strictly narrow, self-interested colonialism to justify why Britain should control Palestine. And that's when the Balfour Declaration is signed and sent to the Zionists. And they say, we believe there must be a Jewish homeland and it should be in Palestine and we will be its protector. And so you see the manipulation of Jews for the benefit of colonial powers. Let's talk about the Balfour Declaration because few other documents have had such a profound impact for, well, more than a century now, because the impact goes on and on. Let's just talk about that as well.
Yeah, I think it's important to think of the Balfour Declaration as sort of a direct precursor to the Nakba, which we're talking about today, right? So you're right to point out that, you know, merely a year later with the Balfour Declaration, the British basically make this commitment to set up a Jewish nation state in Palestine. And hopefully in our conversation, we can talk a little bit about what it means to have a demographically defined nation state. But, you know, this idea that there would be a British mandate over the region until a Jewish state could be established revealed a deep hypocrisy on the part of the British, because the British had promised Arabs that it would fight for their national liberation, that it would fight for their independence from the Ottomans. It made that promise back in 1915, so 2 years before Balfour. And then, of course, just kind of turns on a dime, and Balfour undoes all of this, which again should come as no surprise to anyone who's studied colonialism. You know, I think people, a lot of analysts have made some apt theorizations about the roots of Balfour. So as you point to it, it sort of promised this bulwark of Western colonialism in this strategically important region. I mean, that is evidenced by, as we mentioned earlier, the sort of top-down nature of these declarations. The Balfour Declaration refers to the indigenous population, Palestinians, as the quote-unquote non-Jewish communities in Palestine, just othering them right from the get-go. But also it's been suggested that, you know, Balfour itself was motivated by anti-Semitism, the urge to sort of remove Jewish people from Europe. This problem population needed to be removed from Europe. And that's a really interesting thing that I think if we look at the, you know, Jewish European sentiment about Balfour and the initially the sort of deep aversion to it, as many folks recognized it as anti-Semitic at the time. So yeah, so Balfour is sort of a key precursor to what we will call the Nakba, the calamity, the catastrophe that is the creation of the state of Israel.
Well, before I go into some of the more recent history, I want to also make this point and get you to comment on it, if you would. Jews in Europe did not want to go to Palestine. I mean, and if you think about it, if people are living in like advanced industrial societies, like Europe was the center of capitalism, modern cities, urban life, you know, people generally don't want to move to a place with a lower level of the means of production, for instance. You see refugee flows from the global south to the north, not the other way around. European Jews didn't want to go to Palestine before World War II. Most Jews in Europe were absolutely opposed to Zionism.
Exactly. And that lends some credence to this theory of the anti-Semitic motivations of the Balfour Declaration itself. I mean, look, you know, I think this assumption that, and it's a terrible assumption that somehow, you know, the Muslim world is uniquely anti-Semitic. I mean, there is this conflation of the Palestinian freedom struggle and Islam in ways we might talk about. But this idea that the Muslim world is somehow uniquely anti-Semitic is itself a form of racism and a deep erasure of the very roots of anti-Semitism, which are, of course, at the heart of Western Europe.
All right, let's go now to this, the creation of the State of Israel, the Nakba, the catastrophe, 750,000 people driven from their homes, ethnic cleansing, massacres by the Zionist forces, working at that point in concert, really, with British colonial forces at the moment that British colonialism says, we're going to leave. Congratulations. We have a new sort of bifurcated place where the Jews will have the State of Israel and then the Palestinians, the historic majority, will have other parts. And the United Nations, as you pointed out, was the the United Nations authored the resolution creating the State of Israel. And oddly, the United States and its main adversary, the Soviet Union, then under the leadership of the Stalin government, both were the first to recognize the existence of the State of Israel. I think the Soviets' calculations were that European Jewry would be lean in a more social democratic direction, and as a consequence, a new Jewish state in the Middle East would be sort of antithetical to the Cold War that was sweeping the world, that they would favor good relations between the Soviet Union and the West. And of course, the Soviet Red Army had been the liberators of people in the death camps. It was the Soviet Red Army, which lost 27 million, Soviet Union lost 27 million people, who liberated Europe from fascism. So I think Stalin and the Soviet government thought, well, Israel will be either sympathetic or neutral to us. Okay. Aside from that calculation or miscalculation, it's the UN that really is behind the State of Israel. But at first, the United States isn't 100% in the camp of the Israeli government. I mean, in 1956, when the Israelis and the British and the French collaborate to invade Egypt and to seize the Suez, the United States government was opposed to it. So Israel had these expansionist designs from the beginning. And I'm going to talk about with you how the U.S. orientation towards Israel evolved and why it evolved, especially in the mid-60s. But the Israeli government from the beginning had an expansionist design. They were never satisfied with the 1948 borders. Al-Nakba wasn't a big enough catastrophe that would have satisfied the Zionist settler government.
And this is why, you know, all serious analysts and defenders of Palestinian humanity recognize that a two-state solution simply means chipping away further at Palestinian land that has already been, you know, so depleted and separated over the several decades you talk about. So, you know, you're speaking about the rise of the U.S. to its, you know, superpower status, which now seems to have been quite fleeting, and its need to itself create its own colonial or imperialist designs in the Middle East. And so, you know, we really cannot understand modern day Israel, which I'm sure we'll talk about, without understanding the role of the United States. I mean, on every level, I think it's something like close to $4 billion annually that the U.S. provides to Israel. And of course, this is at a time when the U.S. economy itself is in shambles. American workers struggle, you know, to afford housing, to afford school, to afford healthcare. There is generous funds available for the state of Israel. I think it's a bit erroneous to think of Israel as sort of a client state of the U.S., and instead to understand the sort of inherent overlaps. They're kind of mutually constitutive. You know, there is no Israel without the U.S., and in many ways, there is no U.S. without Israel. So I spoke earlier of these deadly exchange programs in which American police departments become increasingly militarized by learning repression tactics from the Israeli military. You know, I work on a college campus. Campuses across the U.S. see increasing, you know, propaganda efforts in the hearts and minds of young learners. So, you know, there's a lot of overlaps between the U.S. itself and the state of Israel.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So let's, and I want to come back to that too. These are really important and big topics, and it's really important for people who are serious to try to, you know, get hold of this history. There's lots of books to read. In addition to our show, there's other videos that people can watch, but people have to acquaint themselves and become knowledgeable in order to come up against the bourgeois pro-imperialist, pro-colonial ideology. So here in 1956, the Eisenhower government opposed Britain and France using Israel to seize a part of Egypt. And so they were against it, and the Israelis stopped. I mean, the Soviet Union was even more ferociously against it. Khrushchev said, if it doesn't stop, perhaps a nuclear missile will land in London or something like that. In other words, it was very, he was very bellicose, and the invasion stopped of Egypt. But 1967, Professor, there's a wave of pan-Arab revolution sweeping the Middle East. And this is really an important moment because the Arab people, the Arab nation, has the capacity to form a very, very large state. There's one language, a historical culture. There's, of course, regional differences, but there's more that keeps people together than that separates them. Common religion, for the most part. And the dream of a pan-Arab state is always ever present because it's the colonizers who divided the Arab state into these separate countries, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria. I mean, this is a project of colonialism for their domination. And the U.S. was very bogged down in 1967. It was losing the war in Vietnam. It was losing the war in Southeast Asia against the communist forces. And the Israelis carry out this, the June 1967 war against all of its Arab neighbors, seizes the Golan Heights from Syria, seizes the West Bank, seizes Gaza, seizes a big part of Egypt. And the U.S. is thinking like, wow, this is an effective military force. Maybe they weren't a client till then, and maybe they're still, as you're pointing out, not a client, but they have a congruence of interest because if the U.S. can't police against this left-wing pan-Arab revolution that's sweeping, the Israelis can be the attack dog. Anyway, that's how I view it. I wanted to get your thoughts, how you view that period, because it seems from then on, the U.S. and Israel have been more or less joined at the hip.
Breakthrough.
Again, that was Brian Becker and Dr. Nazia Kazi on the issue of Israel. We are going to take a break here on Breakthrough Radio, but we'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Breakthrough.
Welcome back to Breakthrough Radio, the best of breakthrough news brought to you for an hour each week. As we continue the show, we return to Brian Becker and Dr. Nazia Kazi discussing the roots of Israeli apartheid policy.
The shape of Pan-Arabism itself was diverse in terms of like the kind of economic project it was committed to. So not all of, you know, Pan-Arab nationalists were necessarily super left or socialist, but were in many instances sort of nationalists, resource nationalists who believed that, you know, the Arab world should reap the benefits, the profits of their own resources, particularly the one right below their soil. And this was diametrically opposed to the interests of the U.S. at this time. So, you know, as we talk about the decades of the Cold War, I mean, the U.S. is opposed not only to communist or left-leaning forces, but to resource nationalists around the world. And, you know, the Middle East is no exception. So I'm inclined to agree with you that, you know, Israel offers a really strategic partnership to the U.S. in this way to kind of stem the tide of Arab nationalism, whether it's resource nationalism or outright, you know, left-leaning socialist movements.
I know you have been working and are working now on a new book about how U.S. imperialism in particular and imperialism writ large manipulated Islam or tried to create a political extension of its own authority and power through different political parties associated with Islam. I'm sure you there's more to it and you can expand on that. But one of the interesting pieces to this discussion, and because it's Palestine and it's a holy land for Muslims and Christians and Jews, a lot of times the emphasis is on religion or peoples representing different religions rather than to understand the underlying economic and political forces at play. So like a materialist, a historical materialist, a Marxist approach requires us not to look at the surface, at the superficial, but to sort of find what the root of the problem is. And, you know, the U.S. often talks about Israel as a parliamentary democracy. And then at the same time as it was supporting Israel, it was supporting the Shah in Iran, who was a secular monarch. And then at other times, the U.S. has supported the Saudi royal family, which is a sort of reactionary Islamicist force. So in a way, it doesn't matter what the form, political form or ideological or theological form is of Saudi Arabia or Israel or the Shah, even though they're quite different, the essence, the root of it has to do with the economic and political interests of imperialism. This is an important part of your study, your works, and I'd like you to just expand for the audience a little bit more about this.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. will ally with any force that either protects or does not threaten sort of ruling class interests here at the heart of empire. That can mean a sort of bourgeois democracy. I certainly don't consider Israel a democracy, but it has, you know, the trappings of parliament and electoral politics, increasingly less so under this far right, increasingly fascist government, which perhaps we can talk about. But it has included, you know, bourgeois democracies. The U.S. has allied with monarchies. The U.S. has allied with secular governments, with religious far right governments like the Saudi government. So the form of the government matters less than its sort of economic commitments. And you're right to point to that. You also mentioned this question of religiosity. You know, I mean, my work looks at Islamophobia, which I think is a topic that is so grossly misunderstood. It's almost rendered this kind of mystical, uniform, kind of anti-Muslim force that exists in this way around the world, as if Muslims are somehow inherently victimized. You know, you can find evidence of this, whether you're looking at the far-right government of Narendra Modi in India, or you're looking at the rise of Donald Trump in the U.S. Of course, there's evidence of anti-Muslim racism. But what I want to add to this conversation about anti-Muslim racism is the ways in which the U.S. has found a key strategic ally in right-wing forms of Muslim religiosity at key moments in time. Now, you know, returning to Israel and Palestine, you're right. People make a huge mistake when they conflate the settler colonial violence, the imperialist project of Israel with some kind of quintessentially religious Jewish-Muslim conflict that misses the point, as we discussed earlier. But of course, Israel itself is committed to propagating that image. I mean, let's remember that it was during Ramadan, very recently, you know, the holy month of Muslims, that there was this assault in Al-Aqsa Mosque. I mean, this happens seemingly every Ramadan when Israel, during the holiest nights of the year for observant Muslims, will carry out these assaults in mosques, which, of course, adds to the perception that this is a religious conflict, that this is Jewish versus Muslim, which couldn't be further from the truth. And I recall a headline, it must have been in the New York Times, which has a really committed habit of doing this when it covers Israel. It said, you know, that Israeli forces opened fire on Muslims who had barricaded themselves in the Holy Mosque, barricaded themselves and implied that there was some kind of military project going on, not the fact that a lot of observant Muslims take the last 10 days of Ramadan to sit in meditation in a mosque. I mean, where was their cultural competency consultant then? So, you know, the urge to render this some kind of a religious conflict is a complex one, and it has many, many roots. But yes, so I am really interested in thinking about how right-wing Islamist forces have been key in shaping U.S. power, and how, more specifically, the Central Intelligence Agency has been a key agent of those projects.
Let's go on to, as we're sort of marching through this history, we started in 1917 with Sykes-Picot and the Balfour Declaration, and then the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, and then the 1956 Suez Crisis, where Israel, Britain, and France team up together to invade Egypt. And again, the British are trying to hold on to the now declining British Empire, which was so dominant all around the world. The sun never set on the British Empire, but in particular, Egypt and the Middle East were vital to British imperial positions. Then 1967, and the Israeli war, where the Israelis seized the West Bank and they seized Gaza and the Golan Heights from Syria and a big part, again, of Egypt. And there's all these resolutions that have been passed by the United Nations. Resolution, well, you will know the names of them, but 242 and others that say, look, it's Israel must return the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights. It finally left Egypt as a consequence of the Camp David summit accords between Jimmy Carter and the Egyptian president and Menachem Begin, the Israeli government. That was in 1979. So Israel leaves Egypt, and in return, Egypt signs its own separate peace with the Israelis, meaning that the largest Arab army is out of the picture, no longer in a confrontational mode with the Israelis. And in the West, that's heralded as a great moment for peace. And the Israelis are thinking, and the U.S. Pentagon and the CIA are thinking, well, okay, Egypt's been shelved. We made a separate peace deal with Egypt. The Israelis then immediately invade Lebanon. That's in 1982, where the PLO was headquartered. And they march and bomb all the way up to Beirut and then occupy Lebanon for the next 20 years until resistance forces drove the Israelis out. But it shows that peace with the Israeli government under its current configuration isn't really peace. Peace means you sideline this army or that army in a separate peace so that Israeli expansionist designs can rev up. And there's this inherent expansionism of the Israeli project. And as you see, every step along the way, it becomes more fascistic, more racist. And even today, now young Jewish Americans who in the past could have been counted on as loyal allies of the Israeli project, and people were being taken to Israel all the time and spoon-fed all the propaganda that Israel is a safe haven from reactionary anti-Semitism, and it's a, you know, our sort of final protector. Now, as a consequence of this march of endless expansionism, embrace of fascism, embrace of racism, a lot of Jewish Americans and Jews everywhere are thinking like, no, I don't want to be part of this. Anyway, let's talk about both of those, the inherent drive of the Israelis and then its political impact.
Yeah, I mean, the Nakba itself was not a finite contained event. Palestinians recognize it as an ongoing event. And that, I would say, becomes essentially clear when we look at the events of the last year. So I'm sure many of your viewers are familiar with the hunger striker, Khader Adnan, who recently passed away after a really remarkable hunger strike to draw attention to his detention for nearly a decade without trial, without charge, which is, you know, just an ordinary MO of the Israeli occupation forces. But what many of them might not know is that his body has not been released to his family. And in fact, the state of Israel has a deliberate practice of holding the bodies of people killed by Israel in morgues. They become sort of this secondary site of incarceration for people. And the reason is because a funeral for someone like Khader Adnan would likely be a huge demonstration. I mean, not just a mourning of his death, a celebration of his life, but a demonstration against Israeli repression. We saw this last year with the murder of Shireen Abu Akleh, where her funeral became a secondary site of Israeli repression, where forces were unleashed on the, you know, the mourners, the people who were carrying her coffin, and were attacked. And, you know, against all odds, managed to keep her coffin raised. So this kind of violence is part and parcel of Israeli apartheid. Last year, 2022, was the deadliest year in the West Bank since the end of the Second Intifada, since in almost 20 years. There's been a remarkable increase in settler raids, attacks. Of course, Gaza has sustained bombings most recently, just a couple days ago. And of course, these bombings don't just take lives, but they destroy infrastructure. They destroy fishing communities. They destroy water treatment plants. They destroy hospitals and school buildings. And of course, Gaza can't rebuild from these because they really languish under this gutting blockade. Even the diet of Gazans is legislated by Israel. So this repressive climate is why we see such a wave of resistance led by Palestinian people, but really around the world. I mean, campuses across this country have SJPs, Students for Justice in Palestine chapters. You find in every city and many towns across this country, BDS movements. That's the Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions movement. The Nation hired Mohammed Al-Kurd, a Palestinian journalist, to write for them. You know, whatever your critiques of her may be, it was Rashida Tlaib in Congress who held a Nakba event, much to the consternation of both establishment Democrats and Republicans. There's the Amnesty Apartheid Report. So, you know, this kind of repression is not going unmet with fierce resistance around the world.
There's an underlying revolutionary element to supporting the Palestinians. And, you know, I want to mention this, and I think it's important for, again, for our audience to kind of wrap their heads around it, think about it a little bit. And I also want to get your reaction. When the war in Vietnam was going on, there was a lot of liberal opposition to the war, and the ruling class had different positions because some parts of the American capitalist ruling class thought the war was a mistake, it couldn't be won, better to cut our losses. When it came to, say, the liberation of South Africa, a section of the ruling class, including Democratic Party politicians, they were out there in front of the South African embassy in Washington getting arrested. In El Salvador, there were sanctuary cities created to support the Salvadoran liberation movement. The same with the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and including a bunch of Democratic politicians. But when it comes to the state of Israel, there's no liberal Democratic Party opposition at all. You mentioned Omar as one, and maybe there's a couple others. It's only a handful. There's 435 members of the House of Representatives. It couldn't be more than three or four or five who actually even take a liberal position in opposition to Israel. And as a consequence, Professor, one of the things that happened in the U.S. liberal anti-war movement was, because there was no ruling class support for the Palestinians, the left also shamefully also turned its back on the Palestinians. It didn't have that kind of liberal wing of the Democratic Party that it was looking to. So it was only like the organization that I helped organize, the Answer Coalition. We broke the taboo on Palestine. We organized a demonstration after the Israeli reinvasion of the West Bank, which happened in the spring of 2002, we had a demonstration of 100,000 people for Palestine. And most of the left forces boycotted our action. They wouldn't support it. They thought, oh, no, you can't support the Palestinians. Hakeem Jeffries, the new leader for the Democrats in the House, I mean, he's giving militant, it sounds like militant speeches in form, except they're for Israel. They're not like traditional civil rights speeches. They're speeches for war. I want to get your opinion. Why is there such like hegemony for the Zionist project or sort of failure for any liberal opposition to really, you know, show itself within the halls of Congress or within the capitalist parties?
Yeah, I mean, you're really right to point to the fact that there is no room in formal American politics to take a stand on Israel. And, you know, when a sort of milquetoast stand is taken by someone who might in some instances be seen as having some pro-Palestinian views, it always begins with, you know, an affirmation of Israel's right to defend itself, which is always a thinly veiled justification for whatever kind of assault the Israeli state has carried out upon the Palestinian people. And so, you know, I mean, there's this bipartisan consensus that you're talking to. And I think, you know, this becomes a really edifying moment for a lot of young people coming to politics when they learn just how uniform this consensus is in American, formal American politics around the question of Palestine. You know, so you can have someone like Vice President Kamala Harris, who's getting all kinds of props from sort of feminist segments of the American population, seeing her as some kind of quote unquote intersectional hero, but then she'll be grinning and shaking the hand of a far right leader like Netanyahu, a person who has now lined his cabinet with people with hate group affiliations, with terrorism charges. So, you know, the American political system is inherently led by the interests of its bourgeois state imperialist commitments, which include this commitment to supporting Israel. And so I think, you know, it would almost be impossible for somebody to attain a high level of political office in this country, especially given, you know, the ways in which pro-Israeli lobby groups exercise inordinate influence over our elected officials. And, you know, you'll often see people campaigning. You pointed to, you know, Hakeem Jeffries, but a lot of people who kind of get a lot of progressive cred. But then when you scroll down to this question, it's uniformly pro-Israel. It's almost like the litmus test for joining the formal American political establishment.
Yeah, indeed it is. It really is. And I think that's why the issue of Palestine, it actually has to be a movement against U.S. imperialism.
Breakthrough. And again, that was Brian Becker and Dr. Nazia Kazi discussing the roots of Israeli apartheid policies. And next, we will turn to the issue of lithium, the new key element in green technology. Three Latin American countries, Chile, Argentina, and Bolivia, control 65% of the world's lithium reserves and could band together to set the price. Breakthrough's Kate Pritzker explains what this would mean and why the U.S. is so obsessed with Latin America's lithium.
Latin America wants to create a lithium cartel that's guaranteed to drive the U.S. crazy. Lithium is one of the most important resources in the world and the central component in batteries, which virtually all electronics, including the rising electric vehicle industry, rely on. While lithium is needed in every corner of the world, the majority of the world's lithium is in just three countries: Bolivia, Argentina, and Chile. These three countries, commonly known as the Lithium Triangle, announced that they want to band together to set the price of lithium, an arrangement commonly known as a cartel. This arrangement would have massive geopolitical implications, which would shift the global balance of powers further to the global south. Here's what you need to know. Bolivia's President Luis Arce recently gave a speech where he called for Latin American lithium producers to band together and form a collective lithium policy. He said, quote, "We must be united in the market in a sovereign manner with prices that benefit our economies." The price of lithium has grown exponentially with the kickoff of the EV revolution. The lithium car battery market for electric vehicles is expected to grow 10 times larger over the next decade. Arce also made it abundantly clear why he felt this cartel was needed. He said, quote, "We don't want our lithium to be in the Southern Command's crosshairs, nor do we want it to be a reason for destabilizing democratically elected governments or foreign harassment." It's no secret that EV manufacturers like Tesla and Ford need Latin America's lithium, and they need it cheap. In 2019, the U.S. openly sponsored a right-wing coup against Bolivia's then-socialist president, Evo Morales. While the U.S. used the usual excuse that they were supporting the coup for the sake of democracy, it's widely believed that one of the central reasons the U.S. was so eager to oust Evo Morales was because of his mining policies. As president, Evo Morales nationalized the mining industry and said that any company that wanted to extract Bolivian lithium had to mine alongside Bolivian mining companies as an equal partner. The coup government under Jeanine Áñez wanted to privatize lithium, but wasn't in power long enough to do so. However, Elon Musk basically admitted that the coup in Bolivia was a coup for lithium in a tweet where someone accused Elon Musk of being involved in the planning of the coup for Tesla's interest in Bolivia's lithium. Instead of denying the accusation, Musk simply responded by saying, "We will coup whoever we want." Elon Musk owns the biggest electric vehicle company in the world and would profit massively from a neoliberal government in Bolivia that's willing to export Bolivia's lithium for cheap. But the most damning evidence of all is the U.S. military Southern Command admitting its intimate involvement in securing lithium in Latin America.
I had a Zoom call with the ambassador, U.S. ambassadors from Argentina and Chile, and then also the strategy officer from Levant, and then also the VP for global operations from Albemarle for lithium to talk about the lithium triangle in Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile, and the companies, how they're doing and what they see in terms of challenges and things like that in the lithium business, and then the aggressiveness or the influence and coercion from the PRC. And so the ability to get those groups together to leverage, you know, what's really happening on the ground and how can we help and you know, who else can we bring to the table to help us figure this problem out and box out our adversaries, box out our competitors by teaming together with each other and others.
Well, you might be asking yourself why a four-star U.S. Army general is calling up lithium companies in Latin America. Consider the fact that the Biden administration issued executive orders designating lithium supply lines a matter of national security for the United States. Of course, when they say national security, they're not saying that securing lithium supply lines is going to cure cancer or heart disease, which kill hundreds of thousands of Americans every year. They're talking about the security of corporate profits and the fact that China is quickly becoming one of the biggest EV manufacturers in the world. The three countries of the lithium triangle, Bolivia, Chile, and Argentina, control about 65% of the world's lithium. Mexico, Peru, and Brazil, who have also expressed interest in joining a joint lithium bloc, would bump that up to 70%. Combined, these countries would basically be able to set the price of lithium by controlling the rate of extraction, similar to the way OPEC controls the price of oil. This would, of course, be devastating to companies like Tesla, who want lithium as cheaply as possible. When Evo Morales was in power, his government nationalized the hydrocarbon industry and used the revenue to cut poverty in half and increase social spending by 80%. When it comes to lithium, Latin America faces a similar choice. Latin America's lithium wealth can be extracted for the benefit of a few transnational corporations or for the benefit of the people of Latin America.
Breakthrough. And again, that was Kay Pritzker on a possible lithium cartel in Latin America. And now we turn to the issue of sanctions, where a new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research exposes the lethal humanitarian cost of sanctions on people in targeted countries. Francisco Rodriguez, author of the report, explains his findings with Rania Kalik and I. Your piece that appeared from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Human Consequences of Economic Sanctions, comprehensive survey of pretty much everything that's out there on this issue. But before we jump into some of what you've learned about these human consequences, could you just give us a sense of the scale of how sanctions are really being used around the world?
Yes. Well, part of what I look at in that study has to do with the increase in the use of sanctions, and there's really quite a striking and remarkable increase. According to our calculations, at this moment, 27% of countries in the world are affected by sanctions, and 29% of world GDP is produced in countries that are affected by sanctions. And that's a huge increase in the past few decades. Just 20 years ago, these numbers were less than 10%. 40 years ago, they were less than 5%. So sanctions have become the instrument of choice of Western countries. They're using it essentially whenever there is an issue that they want to deal with in terms of foreign policy, their country's not doing what Western countries would like them to do. They're using sanctions. So now they're affecting a very large part of the global economy and of people in the world.
And in terms of like the actual damage they do on a more like countrywide level, we know that sanctions actually do end up leading to not just, you know, devastating people's ability to like find work and devastating entire countries' economies, but also like to unnecessary death. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, that's correct. So I looked at 32 studies, old quantitative studies that have been published on the effect of sanctions using both cross-national data and country-specific data. Of those, 30 find consistent negative effects on living conditions ranging from per capita income, life expectancy, quality of life, malnutrition, stunting, also in terms of human rights, they lead to a deterioration of human rights. Some of the estimates indicate very large effects. So, for example, multilateral sanctions lead to a decline in income per capita of 26%. That is the equivalent of the Great Depression. They lead to a decline in life expectancy of 1.2 years for males and 1.4 years for females. That's the equivalent of the global effect on life expectancy of the COVID pandemic. They lead to increases in HIV rates HIV rates among children, to increases in child mortality. Everywhere we look, we're essentially, the estimated effects are similar. If you impose sanctions on a country, economic sanctions in a country, the estimated effects are similar of those of that country becoming engaged in an armed conflict.
Wow. I mean, that's, wow, those are amazing numbers. And I mean, we've seen some of, the country that you highlight in the report, of course, well, they're all in the news quite a bit, but Venezuela, and you are Venezuelan, is obviously really at the heart of a lot of the discussion around sanctions, because there's a bit of a back and forth between the U.S. government and the Venezuelan government about what the real impact of sanctions has been on the Venezuelan economy. Having looked at the data, what can you tell us about that?
Yes. Oh, it's very clear that they've had an impact. Now, that doesn't mean that they are the only cause of Venezuela's economic crisis. Generally, economic crises are complex phenomena. They're multi-causal. There are many factors that impact on them. We know that the Venezuelan economy was very poorly managed during several years. We know that the country had a large oil boom, which it didn't use well. So it wasn't prepared when oil prices started declining. It wasn't prepared to handle that decline. So there's definitely a policy component. But we also know that when oil prices started recovering, the economy wasn't able to actually enjoy the higher revenues from those oil prices, because oil production started declining. And there's a lot of work identifying the effects. I have a recent paper in the Latin American Economic Review measuring the effects of sanctions on oil production. And sanctions are a key contributor, if not the primary contributor, to a decline in oil production. And what you have to understand about the Venezuelan economy is that oil it accounts for 95% of the country's foreign currency revenue. Oil revenues went down by 93% during the past 10 years. So obviously, if you take an economy and you take its only source of revenue away, then the economy is going to collapse. Venezuela has seen the largest decline ever observed in GDP per capita in a country outside of wartime. It's a 72% contraction in GDP per capita. And it's also seen, as a result of those deteriorating economic conditions, the largest migration exodus ever seen in the Western Hemisphere. In all of those phenomena, there is definitely, decisively, a very significant impact of economic sanctions on the country.
Yeah, I just want to point out, you in the paper you write, the collapse in Venezuela's oil production is of a dimension that we only see when armies blow up oil fields. That's a really, I think, important and stunning way to put it.
Breakthrough.
That was Rania Kalik and myself interviewing Francisco Rodriguez on the humanitarian cost of sanctions. And that'll do it for us here today for Breakthrough Radio. Don't forget, you can find everything you heard here on our YouTube page, Breakthrough News, in video form. And you can also find us on social media at BT Newsroom. For Breakthrough News, I'm Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
Moment here. It's a moment where we have a chance to actually demonstrate our power.
Imhotep Gary Bird, heard on WBAI Friday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m.
I learned from Dr. Walter Fauntroy, who fought with Dr. King in the Civil Rights Movement, that there were five areas that they identified that they felt politics could control and hit. It was health, housing, education, economics, and social justice. The fact is, WBAI is a nexus for the progressive community to make those changes in all of those areas, and has been decade after decade. I say to you again, whose station?
Our station.
Whose control?
Our control.
Long live WBAI.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
Do you think this war will ever end?
I don't know. They'll just have another one.
I want to get out of here. Don't you?
Not that much.
So you like it here?
It's not that bad.
You're in a foxhole with a war raging outside.
I know. That's why I'm sure glad I've got my WBAI.